Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us for the third episode in our podcast series on policy and practice. Today, we will be discussing the government's proposals for reforming the rules on judicial review, where those proposals might lead to in the future, and what this might mean for businesses. My name is Jonathan Pratt. I'm a senior knowledge lawyer at Macfarlane's. I'm joined by David Gork, our head of public policy, and Gideon Sannett, our head of tax litigation. David, I think it probably makes sense to start with you. Could you maybe start by telling us a little bit about why the current government is so interested in changing the rules on judicial review?
Well, I think there's a one specific incident, and then there is a wider point as well. The specific incident was the Miller case, particularly Miller 2, just before the 2019 general election, which was due to the prorogation of Parliament. Very controversial at the time. There was an expectation when that case began that the government would succeed, that the prorogation of Parliament would be found to have been lawful. But the Supreme Court unanimously declared that it was void, and that was enormously politically controversial at the time, and in the Conservative manifesto that followed not long afterwards, there was mention there of reform of judicial review. So that was the specific moment, I think, when this crystallised. But there has been a wider point as well, partly on the sort of right of politics, that sort of sense that there are too many elements of the right of politics, elements of various institutions which are seen as being perhaps a bit hostile to their agenda, and that the judiciary was seen as part of that, and that it's all very well winning elections, but then you have all these checks and balances that get in the way, and that was proved a bit frustrating. So there's been a long-standing sense, and we've had the policy exchange, review of these matters, and concerns about judicial activism for quite some time. Combine that with perhaps the sort of traditional response that governments of all colours sometimes feel is when things get in the way. When you're trying to get on governing the country and you're making decisions, and then someone comes along and says, actually, you haven't followed a proper process. It's all a bit irritating, and you can hear Blair government ministers who will share that frustration. But I think it's felt much more strongly in a government that really doesn't like having checks and balances, that constrain it and argues much more that, we're democratically elected and, it's our job to implement the will of the people, and get very frustrated if anything gets in the way.
So is this part of an increasing trend with governments, do you think? I mean, when you were in government for the first Gina Miller decision, did you have the same kind of reaction? Were you thinking about pesky judges overstepping boundaries?
Oh, there was irritation within government. There was no doubt about it. But without getting too political here, I think there was a sort of slight difference between the May government, where there was sort of sucking of teeth and rolling of eyes, and the Johnson government, which was about, maybe we need to rewrite the way that judicial review works altogether. So I think there were sort of remarkably different reactions, but you've still got that sort of sense of frustration. Of course, I mean, then to some extent, pick up the story, it's all very well saying you've got a problem with judicial review. And you have had people like Jonathan Sumption who have argued that sometimes there has been judicial overreach. But then what do you actually do about it? And that's where the government has sort of found that perhaps a little bit more challenging, because how do you try and constrain judicial review given that you pass a law, well, the judges will interpret that law, or do you make it so absolutely rigid and strong and so on, and then you're running into questions about whether judges can properly do their job or not?
And the proposals have faced a fair bit of opposition, including from the government's own backbenches. Why do people object to these proposals, and why is it such a big deal to them?
Well, you've got this challenge, of course, that the government having sort of promised to do a lot on judicial review, commissioned the Faulks report, and that came back with fairly modest proposals. The then Lord Chancellor, Robert Buckland, said, well, we'll keep reviewing this. They've then come back with a bill that goes further than the reports, but is nowhere near as far as some thought they might have done if you go back to 2019. But you still got this sort of challenge between, you know, governments wanting to kind of get on and do things and go further. But then you've got someone like David Davis, for example, on the Conservative backbenchers, who's sort of looking at the rights of the individual and saying, oh, hold on, maybe this isn't right. And I mean, what's remarkable is that David Davis and Dominic Raab are old friends. Dominic used to work for David many years ago, but they seem to be on a different side of things, with David Davis saying the current bill goes too far, Dominic Raab indicating that he wants to go much further than the current bill. But I think it's just some different instincts about whether it's sort of protecting the rights of the individual and trying to control the executive, which is kind of where David Davis is coming from, or whether it's a sense of, you know, we've got to control the judiciary and they're too ambitious and they're overreaching, which appears to be where the Lord Chancellor is coming from.
And you mentioned that the current proposals are less ambitious than was it originally suggested. Where do you think they stand on the scale? I mean, how much does the proposed bill change things?
Well, it changes things into, and I'm sure Gideon will come in here on some of the details, but on, you know, certain types of judicial review, sort of cart cases, that this is, you know, there are steps here. There's concerns about immigration cases, where there are a lot of these matters, but they don't very often lead to success. So you've got that, but it's not... It's not anything like as fundamental a change to the system. So most of those, you know, controversial judicial review cases that get talked about, it's hard to see how this bill would change any of that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if I step in, obviously taking the traditional role, you know, the politician deals in the kind of the high level and then leaves it to the lawyer to deal with the annoying detail. Yeah. I mean, there was a real concern, I think, among the legal industry, if we call it that way, about the extent to which they were looking at changing the judicial review rules, and a lot of collateral damage. And I suspect we'll talk a bit about that collateral damage in a little while. I mean, in a way, as David has said, the Folks Review helped. I mean, it did that thing that governments, you know, don't expect independent reviews to do, which is come up with the wrong answer. But, you know, fundamentally, the report turned around and said, actually, the judicial reviews are working pretty well. The bill, that, as we have it, looks a little bit like what they can get away with right now as a result of what Falk said. So the two things, getting into a little bit of the detail as to what it does. Number one, it gives greater discretion to judges about specifically quashing orders. Previously, a judge on a judicial review would quash a particular decision. That quashing of it would happen effectively from the start. Now, the bill allows a judge to turn around and say, well, actually, this should be quashed, but I'm going to suspend it. I'm going to give the government, I'm going to give the public body in question some time to fix it. What's actually a little bit ironic, I think, about that particular rule is it may well encourage judges to have more judicial review on the basis that it's no longer such a blunt instrument. In other words, if a judge is sitting there thinking, well, I don't really want to quash it because that's a really extreme approach to take, actually you're giving more power to the judges to have more of a nuanced decision. So it's one of the ironies of this that actually the consequence of trying to limit judges' power is actually to give judges greater discretion. The other point that David has touched on, and the so-called cart jurisdiction, really just prevents judicial review from being used as a way of appealing upper tribunal decisions, and that primarily relates to immigration cases. So some of those high profile cases that we've seen in the news, this at least gives the government a bit of a win in being able to say, well, look, we now have a freer hand, not being bothered by those pesky judges in terms of immigration cases. So, but that's, that's very much, you know, these are sort of big ticket disputes, if you like. This is kind of very much the political side of things. I guess the question is, what is the government going to do in the future? And I mean, David, you might have a better read on that.
Well, I think it is interesting. There was this interview that Dominic Raab gave with the Sunday Telegraph that talked about judicial review, also talked about the role of the Human Rights Act. It was interesting when Dominic became Lord Chancellor, there was quite a lot of speculation as to what he will do in this area. You know, there's a lot on his plate in terms of prisons, in terms of the probation system, in terms of the courts and tribunal system, and catching up with the backlogs that have developed, particularly since COVID. Or is he going to sort of turn to areas where he was very interested in when he was previously in the MHA, twice a junior minister in that department? And when he was there previously, particularly his stint when Michael Gove was Lord Chancellor, Dominic was very interested in the Human Rights Act and whether there should be a British Bill of Rights. And in his interview, he's raised particular issues with regard to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, and questioned the role of the European Court of Human Rights. But he's also talked generally about judges having too much power and the sort of mechanisms about, if they make a wrong decision, then how do we correct it and so on. Now, nobody's quite clear where all this is coming from, where it's going, but it's sort of coming from a perspective of this suspicion that decisions should be made by ministers, they should be made by parliamentarians, and the judges should stay out of politics. And how you actually go about delivering that and implementing that is one question, but it does look like a sort of shift, and it does look as if Dominic Raab, in terms of his position as Lord Chancellor, wanting to kind of carve out a particular role for himself. No doubt he sincerely holds this view as well, but he wants to sort of make headway in this area. And that interview in the Sunday Telegraph does demonstrate, sort of some ambition, if that's the right word, in this field. As I say, the challenge is, particularly when you're looking at judicial review, after there have been, there's been a report on this, how do you find a practical way in which you can constrain what the judges can do without fundamentally getting in the way of what the judges are supposed to do. We'll see what comes out. We don't really have the sort of details here, but I think there's a distinct sense of where Dominic Raab wants to go.
And I think the concern, I say, from our perspective, is in a way we say judicial review and everyone sees the news and the Miller 2 and immigration cases. But I mean, there are thousands of judicial review cases that are brought every year, and the majority of them are not the headline issues. They are, industry regulators making decisions, or other public bodies, local council, local government, or in an area that I obviously deal with a lot, the tax authority. And there is this sense of a trend in, as you were talking about, David, about government just wanting to be able to get on with things. But the concern, or the thing that we look out for, is whether that extends beyond, if you like, the front bench, through the back bench and all the way down the street to the tax authority, to the industry regulators, financial services, and more power being given to them in terms of rules and decisions that they're making. Sometimes decisions that have no formal appeal rights, so that if you're the subject of these things, then you have nothing else that you can do apart from judicial review. And so in a way, we can you can see why government wants to get on with the business of being government. But for businesses, that may end up translating into, you know, the tax authority just, you know, itself wanting to get on the business of, you know, hitting particular industries. You know, we've seen that in the past with kind of tax avoidance schemes. You've had accelerated payment notices where really
I remember them well.
Well, yes. That's yeah. why I mentioned it. I thought I could get some inside information. But other regulators as well, you know, financial services, ombudsman, and so on, that theme of just being able to get on with things in an administrative sense becomes a real headache for business where they disagree with what's being done. And the ministers may not be as focused on the detail because they've got that big picture. I mean, I don't know, to what extent is that an issue?
Yeah, and I think this, if you like, comes back to some of the concerns raised by David Davis. But I think there is an interesting point to be made about the centrality of, if you like, the rule of law within our system. It provides a great deal of stability and certainty. Now, you know, critics will say, well, rule of law is one thing. We don't want the rule of lawyers. So I can understand that. But you know, the sense of trying to get the balance right between the rights of the individual, whether that be a person or whether that be an individual business, with the ability of the state to execute its functions efficiently, there is an important balance, and there's not always an intention. You know, I sort of sometimes feel there's a sort of one aspect of this argument that can be missed off. If you are a minister and you are considering your options, you know that judicial review is sort of on your shoulder. Now, that can be frustrating, but it could also be a good discipline. You know, are you going through this process properly? Are you making sure that you are understanding the full implications of this and balancing the government's objectives with the rights of others? So I personally think that the fear of judicial review, I mean, you know, sometimes it means you have to read quite tedious documents and sign off that you have done that. But that does impose a discipline on ministers, or as you say, Giddy, in other parts of the state. So I think, you know, to editorialise for a moment, I think, you know, it, for a number of reasons, it plays an important role here. And, you know, this is not just about, you know, pure politics or left-wing campaigning groups or, you know, immigration cases. This also has a more wider implication for businesses wanting to ensure, you know, for example, who have an interaction with the state, you know, whether that be the HMRC or whether that be a regulator or whatever it might be, if any entity, any part of the state acts in a way which is unreasonable, acts beyond its powers, there is that opportunity for the judiciary to step in.
Yeah. I mean, the best way to avoid a dispute or to settle a dispute is, in a sense, what you're talking about, is that kind of transparency, having an idea on where the good law lies. So having the sense of someone sitting at your shoulder and saying, well, is this good law? Does this work? Is this reasonable? And from our perspective, in a sense, kind of working on the ground with businesses, is a question of the extent to which business feels it needs to get involved in that process. And again, there are lots of consultations. Government's always running consultations, and they always say, you know, actually, we want to hear from business. To the extent that judicial review is under scrutiny, and the circumstances in which judicial review can be brought might in the future be more limited, from our perspective, I would say that puts more pressure on business to be involved in that process, if only so that down the line, if there is a problem, then you can point to representations that have been made, things that have been said, whether it's to ministers, to the revenue, to other industry bodies, so that you are prepared for a circumstance in which it doesn't work out, where a mistake is made. Public bodies make mistakes all the time, inevitably, but you're as prepared as you can be to turn around and say, no, look, this is not how it should work. And we've got all these representations, all this material to back that up. In a sense, what sometimes happens, and when we do judicial review, probably the biggest issue is the history of it is missing. So we're doing something that involves a decision that was taken or an industry agreement in the 1990s, for example. Well, that's great, but where's the evidence of it? Where are the representations? Where is this documented? So to me, it seems that that puts much more an emphasis on businesses really making sure that, you know, government, public bodies actually understand where they come from, rather than 10 years down the line saying, oh, well, this is all very unfair the way you're doing things.
And I mean, it's probably worth distinguishing between the proposals we've got now and some of the concerns we've expressed about what might happen in the future. Gideon, in terms of the proposals we've got now, do you think there are any specific changes that businesses should be making at the moment?
Well, as I say, I think it's less about what's on the page now and what's going to be on the page in the future. As I say, there may be an unintended consequence of this, which is that actually judges feel they need to be more robust on judicial review, because inevitably when judges are told that they shouldn't do something, then like all good lawyers, they do the exact opposite and rush into it and say, well, no, we absolutely should be doing that. We're definitely the best people to be doing that. And again, where you have, as I mentioned before, the bill is giving more discretion to judges, that may well encourage judges actually to, you know, to allow certain judicial review cases. I suspect that judges will still be on notice. So even though they may robustly defend what they're doing, I think they will be more cautious about how they approach things. They will be a bit more nuanced about it. So as far as businesses are concerned, I think I would say, actually, the judicial review case is not a case you're facing today. It's the case that you face in 10 years' time, which is really, you know, at the end of the process when all of this comes out. And businesses just need to be very aware of the different relationships that they have. You know, there are far more regulators and interested parties today than there were 20 years ago. And businesses just need to be very alive to that relationship, to properly interrogate what they're doing and make sure that, you know, something that seems obvious to them is also obvious to, you know, the public bodies. I mean, you know, sometimes we complain about the revenue, but we can't expect them to know everything about every single business. Businesses do have something of a responsibility and a self-interest in making sure that those institutions know what they're doing. And then that way, in the future, when they have a complaint, it's a legitimate one.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that the proposals seem to give the judges more power. David, if I might ask you, there must be a risk that the government will not be happy with any changes or not think they go far enough. Coming down the track, what do you think their next steps might be if they want to build on what they're proposing now?
Well, as I say, I do think, you know, there seems to be some indication as that Dominic Raab is not content with where we've got to on judicial review, that he is perhaps more radical than his predecessor, Robert Buckland, in this area. And the indication is that he does want to go further. The challenge, though, is how you actually do that. And I've not yet seen a kind of convincing example or, you know, worked out policy that addresses this. So I think we're right to think that this is something to keep an eye on, that businesses and wider society, you know, should be aware that it is possible that government will try to reform this area further. But how it will do so, I think, is still provoking quite a lot of head scratching. So, what is it precisely that they would do? You know, would they, for example, legislate to sort of say you can't, you know, that these areas are outside the scope of judicial review? That's a big move to try to do that. And, you know, are we really saying there are no circumstances in which government might act, you know, completely unreasonably, that still the courts could not intervene. Maybe that is where they're going to go. But as Gideon says, we're not there yet. And I don't think, although, you know, you will find objections, Liberty, for example, have raised a number of objections to what the government has already got within its judicial review bill. I think the debate is really on what happens next, but we're still somewhat in the dark until, you know, Dominic Raab comes forward with further proposals.
Okay. Well, it sounds like this is one to watch for the future. David, Gideon, thanks very much. That's been really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.